This is John McMullen. Welcome you to the initial broadcast of the John Mack Radio Show. By way of introduction, I'm a writer, poet, college professor, technologist, denizen of cyberspace, and possibly, with a recent attendee that a lecture of mine called me, technology philosopher. I don't really know what that means, but it sounded good. I look for these shows to be eclectic in nature, as my interests include not only the fields listed above, but also literature, politics, old-time radio, sports, economics, and current events. My goal is to provide information in a way that will keep you, the listener, interested and wishing to interact. I expect to have fascinating guests and go into topics of conversation, of concern, and or enjoyment to the audience. The shows themselves will be live in this time slot, 7 p.m. Sunday evenings, and will be archived both through the network and at my web home, www.johnmack13.com. That's www.johnmack13.com. Also at that location are links to my videos, podcasts, weekly columns, and radio and TV interviews, as well as the schedule of upcoming episodes of this show. Speaking of the network, this show and a growing number of others are brought to you through the facilities of Rapid Radio Network. I got hooked on radio at a very, very young age when I saw my father on the Atlantic City vacation hovering over the portable radio to listen to a Democratic National Convention. I didn't know anything about the players or the politics, but I understood in some way that he was feeling the drama of what was happening someplace else through the magic of radio. The feeling came home to me when I first heard the melodious voice of Fred Foy saying, "Let us return now to the thrilling days of yesteryear. When out of the past come the thundering hoofs of the great horse Silva, the Lone Ranger rides again to usher into the thrice weekly 7:30 p.m. Monday, Wednesday, and Friday on what was then WJZ in New York radio." These words became pitches in my mind of his faithful Indian companion Tonto and his nephew Dan Reed, letters to become the father of Brett Reed, the Green Hornet. I also read the books by the writer Franz Stryker that led me into developing the lifelong the love of reading as I did. From then on, radio had me. From the days of the mysteries, comedies, variety shows, and serials, to the years of music, and finally to all news and to talk radio. Over the years, I called in to a number of shows, and each time I left with envy for the people who were on the air. I was the CB or Captain America KSC 9932, then a ham, WB2 RWC, as well as the lifelong denizen of online virtual reality and Facebook. All of these experiences led me to tonight. So let's get started. My first guest for the series is Dr. Paul Levinson, professor of communication and media studies at Fordham University. In addition to serious writing on communications and media in our digital age, by my count, 6 books of his own and 1 collaboration, translated into 14 languages, Paul is an accomplished science fiction writer with 5 novels, 1 collaboration, and an anthology of his short pieces. I'm sure that he will correct me if my numbers are wrong. Paul's books are, of course, available on Amazon. Additionally, Paul is a musician with an album, Twice Of Upon a Rhyme, just released. He is a blogger reviewing television shows of genre and genre. In short, he has a wide variety of interest and talent. I first became aware of Paul when I was teaching at New York's New School for Social Research and was a New York editor of an online technology news service, News Bites. I found that Paul was running an online graduate program also at the New School, one of the first in the country, and I called him to interview him. In succeeding years, Paul moved to Fordham, and I was in touch with him for a number of the pieces I was writing. Last year, we were part of a panel of 10 authors at Coogan's Restaurant, a terrific place in Upper Manhattan, adjacent to New York Presbyterian Hospital. At the end of the panel, we had book signings and sales. The turnout had been small. It was a beautiful summer day, but one benefactor bought every book, and Paul had so many more titles than anyone else that he made out there. By reason, we saw Paul on the WCBS TV Evening News, and he's previously appeared on Fox and on CNN as an expert resource. Let's find out more about the talented Paul Levinson. Good evening, Paul, and welcome.
Well, hey, it's great to be here, John.
So let's get some background information. Where did you grow up, go to school? What did you do before the new school?
Well, I grew up in the Bronx on White Plains Road and Allerton Avenue. And before the new school, I was teaching at Fairleigh Dickinson University in Teaneck, New Jersey, in case there are any people living there who are familiar with that place. But actually, well before then, probably, at least in my view, the first really exciting thing I did, and you alluded to it, was record that album, Twice Upon a Rhyme. That was released in 1972, and I was ahead of my time because you know how people self-publish all the time now on Kindle? Well, back then, the various people in our group and I took the album around to a lot of different records companies. We even had John Hammond at Columbia University, Columbia Records, pretty close to offering us a deal. But I've always been impatient, and so after doing that for 5 or 6 months, getting some interest, but you know nothing definite, we decided to create our own record label, Happy Sad Records. And that's really the first experience I had, not only as someone getting music out there to the world, but actually creating my own, in effect, publishing company and record company. I'd had records out on Atlantic Records and Buddha Records, so my singing and songwriting had been out there, but nothing as ambitious as this album with 13 songs. And so I was really delighted when we skip ahead to the 21st century, and first a magazine in Japan called Record Collectors Magazine had a whole issue devoted to little-known cult classics, and they included Twice Upon a Rhyme. Twice Upon a Rhyme may have been little-known, that part of it was true, but as far as I knew, it was not a cult classic. But just reviewing the album in that issue of the magazine began attracting a lot of attention. And in 2010, a South Korean record company gave me a whole lot of money and reissued Twice Upon a Rhyme as a CD. Really? And then the year after, a small British company, Whiplash Records, remastered the whole album and released as vinyl. So that's probably the main thing I was doing, at least looking back now, of any real, real lasting importance before you and I met back in the early 80s.
Where did you go to school, Paul?
Well, if you want to go all the way back, I went to PS 96, then Junior High School 135, then Christopher Columbus High School. Then I went to City College for a couple of years. I dropped out to actually focus more on music. But in the mid-70s, I went back to college at New York University. I stayed there, got my undergraduate degree, went up the street to the new school where I got my MA degree. That's why a few years later we were doing the online program through the new school. And then I went back to NYU to get my PhD.
How'd you get into that online program? Because that was fairly unique at that time.
Well, I was at a conference in Philadelphia at Temple University. And I was sitting at a table with a couple of people talking about a paper that I was going to be presenting. And there was a guy at the bar who was listening with rapt attention. And whenever anyone listens to anything I say with rapt attention, I take notice. So I invited the guy to join us at the table. And it turned out his name was Bob McAndrews. He was one of the founders of the Western Behavioral Sciences Institute online program. This is 1983. And so he asked me by the end of the conversation, you sound like you have interesting ideas. Would you be interested in teaching a course for us? And I said, sure. And he said, but, you know, you're not going to be coming out to La Jolla, California, which is where the program was headquartered. So I wasn't too happy about that because I like La Jolla, California. But he said, you're going to be doing almost all of this through computers. And I said, well, I don't yet have a – I knew about personal computers, but I said I hadn't gotten around to buying an Apple computer or anything else. He said, well, don't worry about it. We'll give you a computer. And so within a few months after that, I was happily typing away on my CPM K-Pro computer. It was an 8-bit computer. I still have it up in my attic. It probably still works. And connected through a modem that was 300 BPS, which was considered a speed demon of modems and connectivity back in those days. And I taught my first online course in July 1983. And after doing that for a year or two, it dawned on me that this was something that could have much wider applicability than in the Western Behavioral Sciences Institute, which was basically a school for chief executive officers and army generals. And I met all kinds of important people there, including Stuart Brandt, the Whole Earth software catalog guy, Rusty Schweikert, who, you know, pretty well-known astronaut. But it was after that I decided to form my own company, Connected Education, with my wife, Tina. And we offered that program through the New School.
Now, when did you move to Fordham, and what is your role there? By the way, you may have taught my daughter, who graduated in communications in 1992 from Fordham, but when did you get there, and what's your role?
Well, unfortunately, I wish I had taught your daughter, but because I could take credit for what I'm sure are her great accomplishments. I didn't get to Fordham, actually, until the fall of 1998,
okay.
And in between, I was teaching at Hofstra for a while. But what happened was, you know, everything's so interconnected. That's what makes life so interesting. The year before that, 1997, Fordham organized a conference about Marshall McLuhan, which was really courageous of Fordham back then, because in 1997, McLuhan was really a lot out of favor. Now, I'd actually been writing a book about McLuhan, and so the people at Fordham knew about that. I'd actually worked with McLuhan in the 1970s. So they invited me to the conference, and as a result of that, they then invited me to come to Fordham as a professor. And one of the things I wound up doing was being director of Fordham's great graduate program in public communications. I was chair for 6 years. So I did as much damage as I possibly could, but now I'm just happily teaching and writing.
Speaking of the book, your first two books, The Soft Edge and Digital McLuhan, were serious books on the evolution of information technology and its impact on communications and media. What then moved you into science fiction? Before you answer that, let me tell the audience that your first effort, The Silk Code, was the winner of the Locust Award for Best First Science Fiction Novel of 1999. But what got you there?
Well, actually, I was writing science fiction all along. And remember I said I got my doctoral degree from the New School, from New York University. Well, there was a time in the late 1970s when I was at New York University, and I was doing two things. I was writing my doctoral dissertation, which was pretty serious, and I was writing my first science fiction novel, which actually is also pretty serious, but presumably a lot more fun than my doctoral dissertation, although I think that's fun too. Anyway, I had this idea that I could do both. And what I would do is I'd work on the dissertation, go to the novel, work on the dissertation. But after a month or two, I saw that I was having so much fun writing the novel that I wasn't making enough progress on the dissertation. So I put the novel aside. And it was at least 10 years before I got back to it in writing science fiction. But once I became more established in the scholarly world, I devoted more and more time to my science fiction writing. To this day, by the way, critics of my nonfiction will say, hey, this feels like science fiction. You know, where's your facts? Where's your evidence? And critics of my science fiction say this is too serious, there's too much philosophy in there. So I take all of that as compliments.
Now, last year you released an author's cut version of The Silk Road as an e-book. What's the difference, if any, between the content of the e-book and the original print version?
Well, anyone who's been an author, a published author, and it is a wonderful thing to be, but it's not all roses and sunshine. There are a lot of frustrations in being a published author. One of the frustrations is you work with an editor, and you work with a copy editor and a proofreader, and regardless of how talented they may be, and I've been lucky, I've had talented editors, they invariably, however, want you to take out passages, do little changes in wording, because if an editor really gets into the editing process, he or she wants to invest him or herself into the novel. And so The Silk Code, being my first novel, although obviously I wrote all of it, some of the decisions about where to go and even specifically what language I would have a character speak were based on what my editor thought would be best. And so the biggest pleasure in doing the author's cut was reinstating a lot of my original wording, hopefully without the spelling mistakes. But in addition to that, I should point out that what the Kindle revolution has done, and this is both for established writers and for new writers, so if there's anybody listening who is a new writer and has never had a book published by a traditional publisher, don't worry, because you can easily publish the book yourself, or there are lots of small publishers out there, and it's a very different ball game. You know, you don't get a big advance, but on the other hand, you have much more power over the promotion of the book, over the presentation of the book. So not only The Silk Code was published as an author's edition in 2012, but actually at the end of 2012, The Plot to Save Socrates was published as an author's edition. And I was so happy with the results in terms of what the book looked like, in terms of sales, that I finally finished the sequel to The Plot to Save Socrates, another time travel novel called Unburning Alexandria. And all of these, by the way, are published by Josara Media, a small, savvy press in Texas. So what I think is going on, getting back to McLuhan, he said back in the 1970s, the Xerox has turned every author into a publisher. And he was onto something, but like many of McLuhan's ideas, it had not really crystallized and reached its full effect when he made that comment, because, look, you can Xerox a manuscript, and the content might be there, but it looks nothing like a published book. But now with the Kindle and the whole ease of digital publishing, every author can indeed become a publisher. And one of the things I talk about in The Soft Edge is the damage that gatekeepers have done to the intellectual process throughout history. All these great ideas that we might not even now know about, but fortunately someone agreed to publish it. And it's really horrifying. You know, the Beatles were turned down by 25 different record companies. Frank Herbert and his Dune series, he was turned down by almost as many publishing houses. So imagine these idiots, these publishers and record company execs who said no to talent like that. So what always haunts me is who knows how many Beatles and other great writers there are out there, but the Kindle has now given them a voice.
Well, beyond the Kindle, the whole publishing on demand, Amazon has this service called CreateSpace that you can publish for as low as $13 or $15. All you do is you submit the book, and they will tell you if it's publishable, if it's in the right format, not for content, and they'll send you a proof. And you have to buy the proof. That's $13 or $15. And if you approve the proof, it immediately goes up on Amazon, and it goes up on the CreateSpace. And if you buy your own ISBN, you can put it any place. Now, the difficulty is, as you point out, that you have to promote it yourself. But publishers don't promote through the traditional process anymore anyhow. They'll promote Stephen King or James Patterson, but the new novelist or the new writer gets very little and has to promote themselves. Very often people, they wind up hiring their own publicist. So it's a whole different process now, and I agree with you that the Kindle and the Nook and the other devices have been tremendous, but there's also a market for hard paper for the time being. You mentioned the plot to save Socrates and Unburning Alexandria. These are about science fiction and the historical in nature. Why and how did you choose to mix the two genres?
Well, you know, it's funny how you get ideas. I was a freshman at City College, so this was 1963. And I'm sitting there, and I'm taking an intro to philosophy class. And I read the Crito, and this is one of the great Platonic dialogues, and it's about the death of Socrates.
Right.
And in that dialogue, Crito, an old friend of Socrates, comes to him and says, look, Socrates, I know the Athenian court has sentenced you to death by hemlock, which is a horrible way to die, by the way, but I have a ship waiting for you. We've bribed the jailers. Your wife and children are on the ship. Let's get out of here. And according to Plato's account, Socrates says, oh, no, you know, I appreciate what you're trying to do, but I may criticize the Athenian state, but I would never put myself above it. And so we're led to believe that Socrates, shortly after that, drank the hemlock. I was 16 years old when I read that, and I said, you know, I don't believe this. I mean, I know that if somebody sentenced me to death for my opinions, and then some friend of mine gave me a way of escaping, you can rest assured I'd escape, and then I'd go to a new place and criticize the government, which, by the way, you know, in effect is what Edward Snowden did this summer, but that's a different story. But in any case, I never believed that Socrates really did that. And so I knew that someday I was going to be writing about it. And once I began publishing my science fiction, my novels were out there and I was getting interest, it just sort of came to me that I ought to write a novel, a time travel novel, that tells what really happened back there in ancient Athens. So I don't want to give anything away in case anyone hasn't read it, but I have no idea if the hypothesis that I came up with is correct, but it's a lot more plausible than what Plato presented.
Well, the Dalai Lama did just what you said. He left Tibet rather than being in prison, as differentiated, say, from Alan Turing, who chose to commit suicide rather than being imprisoned. You also have this ongoing TV blog, Infinite Regress. What does it cover, and how often does it update it?
Well, television is one of my great loves, and I always watch television. And, you know, I remember saying back in the 70s when people were saying, oh, television damages the intellect. You know, so far, as far as I could tell, my intellect is just fine, and I watch a huge amount of television. And if anything, television has gotten much better. So for people who are listening now or, you know, in the future, I cover shows that I think are spectacular, and most of the time I agree with what other people think are great. So tonight I'll be watching and reviewing the next-to-last episode of Breaking Bad, which has had a fabulous finale season. I'll be reviewing the series finale of Dexter, another class show. I already reviewed tonight's episode of Boardwalk Empire because I got an advanced copy, and that will be published. I scheduled it to be published at 10 p.m. tonight. So basically, I review at any one time in any week 7, 8, 9 shows. Now, obviously, in the fall, there's a combination of great shows still on from the summer, which Breaking Bad, Dexter would be an example, Ray Donovan another example, The Bridge, Broadchurch, the BBC show. So I'm reviewing those, but also the new shows are now beginning to come up, and everyone can rest assured I'll be reviewing Homeland next week and all the new shows that are coming back, The Good Wife, on the networks, and so on. So it's another example of doing what I love. And last time I checked, I had 1,200,000 views of my Infinite Regress television review blog, which I started in the fall of 2006.
That's terrific. My son is a television writer and producer, and he's wired into the industry, and he's written for shows like Alias, and he really enjoys his career. I see we have some callers. Let me see if they have any questions for you. Caller, are you there?
John?
Yes.
Hello, it's Maggie.
Hello, Maggie. Do you want to talk to Paul?
I actually want to talk to both of you. The show is wonderful. It's so interesting.
Well, we had some technical difficulties, Maggie, as you probably heard. We were off the air for about 10 minutes.
Yeah, but, you know, I had those technical problems as well in the beginning, so you shouldn't worry about them too much.
Paul, for your information, Maggie hosts a Wednesday night show, political in nature, from Washington, and she's had programs on the on New Jersey politics, and her show last week was related to the shootings on the Navy base, and I've been a guest on her show.
Well, it's good to
meet
you,
many
Maggie.
Times. Hi there, Paul. How are you?
I'm fine. You know, Maggie, you sound just like Maggie on the Newsroom. You have almost the exact same accent.
I'm guessing that's a TV show.
It is a TV show.
But Maggie's from Ireland originally, Paul.
Okay. Well, the Maggie on the Newsroom is from someplace in the British Isles. So.
Really?
Yes, absolutely.
Wow. I must start watching TV. I heard you say you watch a lot.
Well, I do. It's good for you.
Is it? Well, you guys are doing great, and you know, I was hesitant to dial in because I was engrossed in the conversation.
Let me pop up. There's one other person in. Let me see if they're wants to speak. Is someone from Long Island? Who's this? Hello. I'm not getting them, so maybe they're not on. I just pumped them up.
They're on some very Long Island, like out there in the cosmos somewhere.
Right. Right.
It's probably Dan.
No, I don't know. Paul, you've got all these things going on. Do you see a connecting thread? Do you connect the dots behind you, or are these all varied interests that take you in different directions?
No, they're all very intricately and even intimately connected. In the depths of my brain. As I was saying before, my science fiction, although, you know, there's some sex in it, adventure, you know, the things you'd expect to find in novels, there's a lot of media theory in my science fiction as well. Obviously, in the plot to save Socrates, a lot of philosophy. And in the Silk Code, all kinds of speculation about Neanderthals having survived into the modern world. So there's a very direct connection between my science fiction and my scholarship. But my music is also, you know, I took great pleasure in the lyrics, although I wrote some music too. But most of my music is really collaboration, where I wrote the lyrics, and in the case of Twice Upon a Rhyme, Ed Fox wrote most of the music. And, you know, the lyrics are poetic, and they deal with serious issues, sometimes even political issues, as did many kinds of music in the 1960s. And as far as television is concerned, my Infinite Regress TV blog, probably about a half of the shows that I review, maybe even more, are science fiction shows, because I love science fiction. Even science fiction that's not that great, to me, is better than, say, a sitcom. Not that I'm some Scrooge who doesn't like sitcoms, but I'd rather watch a science fiction show about just about anything. So there's that connection there. And then in addition to that, you know, shows like Mad Men, The Newsroom, they're very media-savvy television shows, and there's a lot that a media theorist can find in those shows. So that's another reason that I review those shows, and there's a connection between that and my scholarly writing. So I try to, you know, do as much as I possibly can. You only get one ride on the merry-go-round, and you might as well make it count.
Yeah, I think The Newsroom was a terrific show. I got turned off on sitcoms when I laugh tracks. I can't stand people telling me when I should be laughing. I automatically turn things off when they have a laugh track. So, but there have been some very big good shows over the years. Now, when you said they're television much better now, some people point back to the Defenders and Playhouse 90 and to things like that, saying that was the golden age of quality television. How do you and your show of shows and this comedy? How do you respond to statements like that?
Well, I think that there was a golden age of television, no doubt about it. And I haven't gotten around to publishing it, but I have a book, you know, somewhere, half in my head, half already written, called The New Golden Age of Television Drama. So I wouldn't take anything away from those great shows of the 50s and even 60s. You know, Star Trek, The Twilight Zone, if we're talking about science fiction, The Defenders was a wonderful show. Dragnet was a great police show. However, I think that what happened with the advent of cable, and beginning most prominently with The Sopranos, is finally television was able to surmount the unconstitutional and childish restrictions that the FCC had placed on them, not being able to use normal language that people use in everyday life, that is not cursing, you know, ever, not showing people without clothes, which in some cases is important. I mean, if you look right now, even at network television versus cable television, anytime you see a couple together in network television in an intimate scene, they're wearing their underclothes. Maybe if it's the woman, you know, they're black. So, okay. But who does that? You know, the fact is, I guess maybe some people do. But as everyone knows, most of the time when you're having sex, you take off all your clothes. Network television is not able to show that. So just on that level, but even really beyond that, what cable television did is free the storyteller from a sort of box in which the show that was being presented couldn't have more than 44, 45 minutes in any hour of content, and there had to be commercials in between. HBO, Showtime, they have no commercials. The network also, if you didn't see the show when it was on, that was it. Even before there were DVRs and people began watching shows that weren't live on the air that way, HBO would rebroadcast the show 2, 3, 4 times during a week. So I think that what's happened is that breakthrough in the mode of presentation of television has liberated writers and producers. And that's why, whether it's The Sopranos, Breaking Bad, Dexter, I mean, these are extraordinarily powerful shows which just couldn't have existed on television in the 1950s and 60s and can't even exist on network television now.
Now, I remember there was great consternation when The Defenders defended the doctor performing an abortion, even though it was to save a woman's life. There was great screaming about that from people. And if you also remember, Dick Van Dyke and Mary Tyler Moore had to sleep in different beds, even though they were married.
I know. It wasn't a happy marriage, I guess.
But Maggie,
come on. It was. It was a brilliantly happy marriage.
Well, not they slept in separate beds.
But didn't everybody?
Maggie, why don't you watch television?
Why don't I watch television?
Yes.
I guess I don't have time, first of all. But the few shows I do watch are almost all true crime.
Okay. So what about political shows like Bill Moyers or the NewsHour even, or the Sunday Morning Show, since you're so tied into politics?
I don't consider that TV. I consider that being informed.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah. By TV, I mean sitcoms, movies, that type of thing. Yeah, I watch everything else I watch.
I think The Newsroom was one of the best shows ever on television. Do you agree, Paul?
Is it still on?
No, the last episode was last week. Will that be coming back, Paul? Because they seem to wrap up so many things in the last episode.
Yes, mm-hmm. No, but it will be coming back. I think I saw that it was renewed for a third season. But you're right, they did wrap a lot of things up. Maggie, it's been on for 2 years, two seasons, and I think and it is coming back for a third season. But you know, you can watch it if you have any kind of cable subscription. There's you usually get like HBO on demand, and it's almost always there.
Right.
By the way, I mean that's another important point. Increasingly, people are watching television shows. Let's say it's 12 episodes at just a few sittings, rather than having to wait once a week for the show to be on the air. And that also increases the pleasure and attractiveness of a television show, because you can satisfy your need to find out what's going on by just watching the very next episode. And as I'm sure John knows, House of Cards was, and also several other shows on Netflix, basically was put up there on Netflix in its entirety. And so it premiered with, oh, I think it was like 12 or 13 episodes, I don't remember. And
12,
you could, yeah, 12, and you could log on to Netflix and just watch them as much as you wanted.
So what do you think of that trend, and what do you think of its impact on cable, the way cable has impacted the networks? So what do you think of that?
Yeah, well, listen, all of this, my doctoral dissertation was called Human Replay, A Theory of the Evolution of Media. And the central point is that media are not static. They constantly evolve, and not only that, they evolve to become more responsive to human needs. It's not as if someone is imposing a medium on us, because if we don't like it, it'll basically pretty much die by the wayside. It won't be successful. And what people want from their television is increasing freedom to be able to watch their shows whenever they want to, wherever they may be, and even in the case of a series, pretty much all at once or just in several sittings. So what's happened, while cable has had this enormous impact on network television, just in the past few years, iPads, all kinds of tablets, smartphones have provided another way of watching television, and Netflix, in a way, has piggybacked onto that. And that's as revolutionary vis-a-vis cable as cable has been to network television, and I think that's all for the good.
One of the problems that I have is, in talking about in these new ways, we record a lot of stuff because of our teaching schedules and everything. And on Sundays, some of the programs that we've set to record, The Good Wife and others, they are constantly impacted by the sports, by the football games. And then they get pushed back, and the cable DVRs don't go automatically to the actual starting time. If it was supposed to start at 10 o'clock, they start recording at 10 o'clock. And when you're getting the end of the big race of Survivor or something, which you don't want to see, you know?
Well, you're completely right. You know, everyone has heard of artificial intelligence. What you're describing is artificial stupidity. There's no reason it has to be that way. The cable stations, the digital technology has ample sophistication so that you could just type in The Good Wife, and The Good Wife would start recording whenever The Good Wife started. So and instead, what you're talking about is exactly right, and many's the time we've been pulling our hair out because we're out of something, we get home, the football game took too long. I don't like football anyway. I mean, I like baseball, but that's another story. I'll probably lose almost all my fans for saying that. But what then happens is, as you just described, you don't wind up recording what you wanted to see.
Yeah, to see the end of the great race, whatever it is, that wasn't what you wanted.
That's right.
What about the news shows and and those shows? Do you tie into them? Have you any comments, for instance, on Fox News as a legitimate news channel, or MSNBC, or?
Well, I not only watch them, I've been on them. You know, you mentioned I was on Fox. I've been on just about all of them, at least a couple more times. In fact, one of the earliest shows that I was on was Bill O'Reilly's show, and I had a good time with him. You know, he's not as tough as he seems. If you keep your wits about you, you can get some good points in and, you know, get your important points across. But as far as you know, the cable news operation, I tend to watch MSNBC most of the time because I tend to agree with the political points of view that their commentators have. I voted for Obama. I'm a progressive. I think that the Affordable Health Care Act was one of the great accomplishments in the past 100 years. I don't agree with everything Obama has done, but nonetheless, I think he's been a pretty effective president. So, you know, Fox to me is laughable, you know, the kinds of, quote, journalism, unquote, they present. But what's interesting, and I would be the first to admit it, is there really has been an evolution of the news shows away from just straight reporting of the news, which was never totally objective. I mean, even, you know, Walter Cronkite had his biases, and the editors at CBS, you know, back then, and there were things they didn't report or didn't report as fully as they should have.
He didn't make the commentary. Eric Severide made the comment.
He did. But I mean, if you think about the Vietnam War, it was a great moment, I thought, back then. I was just a kid when Walter Cronkite said he came out against the war. Well, he could have done that 3 years earlier. Instead, they'd just been presenting, masquerading as objective reporting, basically supportive reporting about the Vietnam War. But in any case, you know, objectivity in news reporting, I think, has always been a myth. But what Fox and MSNBC have done is they've made it their flying colors, and I think that's fine. I mean, I haven't watched Fox in a while. They're still saying they're fair and balanced. I don't know why they say that. They should say we're biased towards the conservative point of view. That's what they are. And MSNBC, if you're looking for objective reporting, is biased towards the progressive view. CNN, in principle, could have a powerful, more objective middle ground, but they're just mostly boring, unfortunately.
Yeah, they all. The people who tend to watch Fox and MSNBC tend to be to some extent zealots. CNN doesn't get the zealots.
Right, that's right.
And it seems to more and more there's so much of division in the country that there's more and more zealots than there are people looking for objective news.
You want to hear something interesting? About 3 or 4 months ago, I can't remember exactly who it was, somebody called me in for a meeting. It was like a sort of a think tank group. And the main topic of the meeting was that Al Jazeera, as I'm sure you know, purchased Al Gore's television station, right? And they're now broadcasting on it. But here's the interesting thing. The basic program that Al Jazeera had, at least then, and I have to admit I haven't watched much of it, was they were going to be the objective news channel in the United States. They were going to try to steer a course between the conservative Fox and the progressive MSNBC. So and maybe they succeeded, I don't know. But that shows you how polarized our news has become, that a newcomer who comes from, you know, someplace not even in the United States, and that's fine, but they are taking on the ideal of being objective.
But, of course, Fox has called them a shill for Al-Qaeda and for other things, so they've been demeaning them since day one. Maggie, with you in Washington most of the time, are you going to be getting active in the New York mayor's race at all?
I've just started to tune into it now. It's getting interesting now, and I'm just so shocked that it wasn't Christine Quinn.
Yeah,
if anybody had asked me 2 years ago who was going to take over from Bloomberg, I would have said Christine Quinn.
We may have another caller, if you'll hold for a moment. Caller,
sure.
Are you there from the 202 area code? Hello?
John?
Yes.
John, this is Don Shea from across the street, Seaman Avenue.
Oh, Donald, how are you? Do you have any comments on anything we've been talking about? You're not too far from Maggie, by the way. But go ahead, Donald.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment. your guest said something about Al Jazeera America.
Right.
And I think that's worth a good look. They are incredibly fact-based.
Mm-hmm.
And when they do have guests on, my take is that the host allows each guest to actually express his or her point of view in a fashion that is more than a soundbite, which is very rare.
I agree with you. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, I haven't seen Al Jazeera America, but, you know, if that's what they're doing, that's very much welcome.
Oh, they're terrific, and they're providing a lot of badly needed reporting jobs here in D.C.
Well, good, good. Mm-hmm. I mean, the times that I've been, especially on Fox, MSNBC is a tiny bit better, and even CNN is not that bad. But Fox, I mean, you can see these clips. I put them up on my YouTube channel, just like search on Paul Levinson. And you'll see what happened when I was on the O'Reilly Factor. He cuts you off after you get like two words out of your mouth.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, he's not really interested. That's why actually Fox has moved from having guests that the anchors disagree with, which they talk all over, into just having toadies that agree 100% with what the anchor thinks anyway. But,
yeah, it's no good.
But I'm glad to hear that about Al Jazeera America, because I think we need that.
We do. They're terrific. Yeah.
Donald, do you have any other questions since you're the late coming to this discussion?
No, actually, my internet service here in Virginia must not be good, because I've heard several of the points, and then I would lose service and I'd log back on. I guess I was thrilled to hear a name from the past, Marshall McLuhan.
Okay.
I think I was in Fordham Platt when he was, I think he had just moved from Canada, Toronto, to the Fordham campus in the mid to late 60s, if I'm not mistaken.
1967, that would have been.
Okay, that would have been my junior year in high school.
Right, right.
And one of my professors, teachers at the prep, was a devotee of McLuhan. So, in fact, he had us read, what was the name of the book, The Medium, The Message?
Well, The Medium is the Massage was the name of the book. The original phrase was The Medium is the Message, which he wrote in Understanding Medium.
He had us read that in high school, which was probably beyond my ken, but worth reading anyway.
Who was the
professor?
Sounds like a smart guy. Do you remember his name or her name?
I believe his name was S. Jerome Martin.
Okay. I don't think I knew him. Yeah.
Jerry was a great teacher. In fact, I don't think I had a bad teacher at that high school.
It's still a great
Let me break in for a moment, because we're coming to the end of the show. Next week, hopefully, we'll have no technical problems. The guest will be a Mother Claire Woodley, who's the rector of St. Mary's Episcopal Church in Treboke, New York, in Mohegan Lake, New York. And she's had a very interesting background, beginning in the theater before she moved into the religious life. So that will be at 7 o'clock next week. Paul, do you have anything else that you haven't had the chance to tell us before we wrap?
Well, just that I want to get back to what I think is like the most profound revolution really in the history of the written word, and underscore what you said about Create Space and what I said about Kindle, because people come up to me all the time and say, you know, I have this science fiction story, how do you get it published? I have this, you know, how do you get it published? And up until about 3 or 4 years ago, I would have to, like, tell them the sad story. Well, you know, you have to try to shop around for an agent. You have to try to go to conventions. The key is meeting an editor, because if the editor doesn't know you personally, despite what they say, sending something in over the transom, you're likely to wind up in a slush pile, and it won't be read even by the editor that you are hoping will read it. All of that has changed, and I think we're just really at the beginning of a new age of literacy, in addition to the new golden age of television, which will be fueled by an unprecedented outpouring of work from people who previously wouldn't have been published. Now, a lot of that will probably be terrible. You know, the downside of no gatekeepers is a lot of drivel can get out there. But that's no big deal, because if you don't like something, you know, put it aside and don't read it. The good news is I think that we will be seeing great work from all kinds of unknown and previously unknown sources.
Yes, Stephen King has a terrific book on writing, which I think is the best writing book I've ever read. And he talks about how that he was rejected so many times, but he had the faith to keep going. Now, many of the stories he was rejected on, later people ran to publish after he was Stephen King. And if he hadn't hit with something, then we never would have known there was a Stephen King.
Well, I'll tell you, without revealing the editor's name, because I don't want to embarrass anybody, I was turned down, you know, some of my science fiction stories, and then when I became, you know, pretty well-known author, I knew that the editors hadn't read it, that it was some kind of first reader, but I sent it along, and because I was then a name, the editor would be reading it, not the slush pile reader, and voila, suddenly all of my great stories were published. So Stephen King is 100% right about that. And the key is you can't let the system break you. You know, basically, you know, I would say to any writer, you're better than the people who are turning you down. So if you have confidence in your work, don't let anything stand in your way.
By the way, Paul, I was talking to a fellow today who had been on a television show with you a few years back, and he was Isaac Asimov's original publisher.
Oh.
He must be 92 now.
Oh, I know who you're talking about. He was on The Evolution of Science Fiction. Yes, on the History Channel. That was probably David Kyle, I think.
Yeah, he's a terrific guy.
Oh, he's fabulous. He's a real treasure. He goes back to the earliest expression of science fiction fandom back in 1939, and he indeed knew Asimov.
Well, he was his original publisher.
Yeah,
he was published
right.
The first Asimov work. Now, I'm told by looking at the board, by the way, that if we're interested, we can keep going. Donald, do you want to add anything to this? Or do you want to ask any questions? Or do you want to talk about politics?
Actually, the one observation I would make, John, it had to do with, you know, losing the filter that sometimes obviously keeps out information that's valuable. Conversely, you know, now we have bits of data coming at us, you know, at lightning-like speeds. And a lot of the information, or data, I should say, not information, has proved to be wrong. And one of the things that concerns me in terms of not only politics, but world affairs and, you know, even community affairs, is an admonition that a friend of mine, I heard him say this back in 1982, well before Al Gore invented the Internet, that we are on the verge of becoming the most well-informed, least well-educated society in human history.
Well, the
I'm not the slightest bit worried about that, Don. I think that we are indeed the best informed and the best educated.
Well,
and, you know, I say this as a college professor, and so therefore I'm involved in the formal education process. And students are better educated now coming in to university classrooms than at any time that I've seen, and I've been before that, and I've been teaching since the mid-1970s. And the reason is they have access to Wikipedia, they have access to the Huffington Post, they can read things for themselves. And that's not to say that everyone is going to come in, you know, the best informed person in history, and it's still a question of choice. But the genie is no longer locked up in the bottle, and it's never been easier for people to get correct information. Let me just make one other point. Wikipedia, as an interesting example, as I'm sure most people know, they don't have an editorial board. Everything that's on Wikipedia is written by the readers, and there can be complete nonsense written there. And I talk about several examples of that in my book, New Media. There's a chapter on Wikipedia. But those errors are very quickly corrected by other readers who know that the information is wrong. And this is such a significant development that Nature magazine did a little scientific study about the level of errors on Wikipedia versus the level of errors in the Encyclopedia Britannica, when the Encyclopedia Britannica was still publishing as a hardcover paperback book. And you know what they found? That the level of errors are pretty much the same. So even though there's it's very easy to say something wrong and stupid on Wikipedia, is corrected that quickly. The problem with the Encyclopedia Britannica is once wrong information gets in there, then who knows how long it'll be before a new edition is put out.
Actually, I remember reading that, Paul.
But one of the
I think you're being too modest. I think Wikipedia fared better than the Encyclopedia Britannica in terms of accuracy.
Well, but I think one of the problems is that, I mean, I'm old enough to go back to when Adlai Stevenson was running and Robert Taft was going to be the nominee until Eisenhower rode in on a military horse. But these people published position papers and people read them. We now have the soundbite society that we don't delve deeply into things. I remember when Barry Goldwater ran for president, Ronald Reagan gave that, what everyone said, the great speech of 45 minutes, 50 minutes on television that so many people in the country watched. How many people that you know would watch the candidate on the 50 minutes now?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the presidential debates had 50, 60 million or more viewers, so somebody is watching them. And, you know, those were not speeches, but, you know, the State of the Union address gets, you know, pretty hefty audience as well. And, in fact, so do most of Obama's speeches. So, I think that there's no doubt that there's a lot of superficial, fragmented, outrightly wrong information on the web because there are no gatekeepers or fact checkers when somebody posts something. But, again, it's corrected that, you know, very easily. On my blog, to give an example, what I do is I watch a television show and I write the review as soon as it's over. And in my eagerness to get the review out there, I sometimes make mistakes. And I'll never forget, a couple of years ago, I was reviewing an episode of Mad Men, and I was talking to the character Rich Somer. The actor Rich Somer plays a character, Harry Crane, and the episode was primarily about him. And 20 minutes after my review was published, there's a comment on my blog, and it's by the actor, Rich Somer, who plays Harry Crane, pointing out that I got an actress's name wrong, you know, in my review. So I thanked him, and I corrected the review. But that's the point. There are so many eyes that look at everything that's on the web that if there's any incorrect information, sooner or later someone unmasks it and or corrects it or gets somebody else to correct it. So that's why I think we are in a world in which there's a net gain in how well-informed and educated people are.
Donald, what's the reaction in D.C. to the Washington Post being sold to Bezos?
I mean, the reaction obviously varies. I think the jury's still out, but I think people realize that the model that the Grant family had was doomed to failure. You know, personally, I think Bezos may save it.
There's some concern with progressives, too, with the Koch brothers seemingly trying to buy newspapers all over. Have you been following that, Paul?
Yeah, well, first of all, I agree completely with Don. I think Jeff Bezos buying the Washington Post can well save it. Certainly the New York Times, which has basically held its own counsel, for a while it looked like their paywall was working, but the number of subscribers began leveling off about 6-7 months ago. We have to face the fact that paper newspapers are just going to take a much smaller part of the pie of how the public are informed than previously, when initially they were the only game in town, and they even suffered, of course, when radio and television became prominent, and now the same is true with digital media. As far as what the Koch brothers are doing, buying up newspapers, I don't really care. I can't stand the Koch brothers, but the truth is they're buying up, like, small-town newspapers. I don't really even know what impact that has on the world anymore.
But aren't they Chicago Tribune, too?
Yeah, well, but, you know, the truth of the matter is, here is something that maybe can explain why I'm not too upset about it. What impact has the New York Post had on New York City? Now, you know, so clearly, you know, Rupert Murdoch is a highly conservative person, very rich person. He's obviously responsible for the Fox News Network. He appoints conservatives to head up his properties all the time. The New York Post, prior to that, I mean, going back, you probably remember this, you know, Jimmy Wexler, when he was writing the editorials, you know, in the 50s and 60s, it was a brand liberal newspaper. And it, you know, it was a tragic day indeed when that got, you know, taken over by such an arch conservative. But did it have any effect, really? I don't think so. I mean, the New York Post maybe thinks it has. You know, circulation is good. But I don't think people's political points of view are molded anymore by newspapers. Maybe 100 years ago, but not now.
I find too many people, and I hang around at my local Barnes & Noble, and I find too many people only read things they agree with. The conservatives read National Review. The liberals read The Nation. Conservatives won't read The Times. Liberals laugh at the Post. I think that it's unfortunate that so many people aren't willing to listen to the other side and to say, well, maybe this guy makes sense, you know?
Yeah, I agree with you completely. That's why I actually try to watch Fox every once in a while, you know, see if I can find anything that I agree with, you know, with their point of view.
Now, Don, isn't the Washington Post, don't they tend to have writers from both sides? I know they have both George Will and Denis J. Dion, for instance.
And Krauthammer.
Right.
You know, I think, frankly, the Post is less liberal than the Times, is my take on their editorial page.
Well, the Times has David Brook, who some conservatives say is not conservative enough, but they also have, and his name escapes me, a very conservative person who I think.
David Brooks writes occasionally, and Brooks is, I think, one of the best additions the Times has made. I mean, he's...
Yeah.
In fact,
yeah.
I don't find that he's not a knee-jerk conservative. I find him to be one of those rare, rare talking heads.
His story, he listens to
his point of view.
Yeah.
His story is fairly interesting. Wherever he went to college, he wrote a parody in the college newspaper parodying William F. Buckley. And Buckley
mm-hmm.
came to speak at the university, and all those people that are there, and Buckley says in the middle of the thing, he said, by the way, is David Brooks here? And Brooks raised his hand. He said, I want to see you afterwards. And Brooks says, oh, my God, he's going to go love me. Buckley opened him a job. And he wound up writing for National Review before he went on to his real career. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, to me, John, the point you made about self-selection of sources of news, to me, is a danger because... You know, if all you're reading or watching or listening to confirms your point of view, which may in fact be wrong, you know, I do enjoy Cromwell said that to the bishops of the Church of Scotland one time, think it by God possible, you are wrong. Well, you know, I think that's what's happened to our political system.
But one thing
nobody's wrong. Everything, you know. And if everybody's right, then why would you compromise?
Well, that
thing I was definitely wrong about. Back in the late 50s and the 60s, the Democrats had the liberals, the Hubert Humphreys and people like that. They also had the conservatives, many of them racist, but they had the Richard Russells and the James Eastland. The Republicans had the New York liberals, the Rockefellers and the Javits, and they had the Goldwaters and the John Towers. And I said, well, you know, it would be better if we had a conservative party, a liberal party, everyone who agrees with it. Well, the way it worked then, Lyndon Johnson, when he was the majority leader, then Everett Dirksen, they had to get some consensus between the various wings of their own parties, and then they could cut a deal. Now we have a liberal party, a conservative party, and they hate each other, and they don't talk, and we see what's going on with the sequester and with the debt deal and with Obamacare. It's disgraceful, I think.
Well, you know, the problem is very few people are like John Maynard Keynes. You know, he has a famous quote, which I've always admired, which is something like, when the facts change, I change my mind. What do you do, sir? And the problem is facts almost never contradict opinions, because there's always some way that you could weave whatever the facts are into supporting your point of view. But that, unfortunately, all of these things are reasons that even great defenders of democracy throughout the ages have said it's the least worst system of government. Or E.M. Forster wrote that book in the 1940s, Two Cheers for Democracy. The problem with democracy is that people are fallible and flawed, and we're not going to remake them, and we're not going to remake the way they think. So the best we can do, I always think, is just provide enough counter-arguments out there so that whatever arguments are presented which are wrong, there are counter-arguments, and maybe some people will be fundamentally convinced. I can't remember in what context it was said earlier. I think you said it, John, about something, maybe Maggie or something did a show after the Navy Yard shooting.
Right.
You know, if you talk about, you know, just fundamental human irrationality, how on earth could anyone support not doing something to make it more difficult for mentally disturbed people to buy assault weapons and any kind of guns, in fact? It escapes me. I mean, there's just, you know, the logic that the NRA uses is just ridiculous, and yet they have substantial support. So what are we going to do, you know, about that? The best we can do is to continue presenting arguments that make sense. And this also gets back to Milton and Thomas Jefferson, that when truth and falsity are allowed to fight it out in the marketplace of ideas, sooner or later truth wins, because people are inherently rational, and they can see the difference between a true and a false proposition. But it's a very sloppy process, and it's not a consistent process, and it's more of a roller coaster. It goes down as often as it goes up. But look, the fact is, we're still here. The United States, you know, since 1776. So, you know, with all the problems, we must be doing something right. So the democratic system does, in its inexact, frustrating way, work for the most part.
Do we have another caller on here from the 631 area code?
Yes, I'm on.
Okay, who are you?
Can you hear me? I'm Bob Blackman. I'm a friend of Paul's.
Okay.
Hey, Bob.
Hi,
how
Paul.
You doing? Good to hear you.
Hi. I have actually a question related to what you've been talking about. I wonder if you've read Peter Beinart's article in the Daily Beast about the new left? And,
I actually haven't, but why don't you tell us about it?
Well. What clued me in on it was that's the title of your recent book, The New Media. So it seems to be that phrase is catching on. You should get a royalty from him. But what he is saying is that the generation that grew up since 2000, which means that they experienced, 9/11, at least as at a very young age, and they've grown up and they've come of age in a deep recession, they are turning into a generation, you know, post-millennial generation that is much more left-leaning than prior generations, that they are more pro-government, more social welfare program-oriented, and that has severe implications for our government and our politics going forward. As severe in a good sense, I mean that they are more willing to try to make government work rather than shut it down, and that they are open to providing adequate social safety nets for the entire population. So that's his new left hypothesis. And he doesn't talk anything at all about how media might have influenced the new generation, but maybe you can fill in the gaps there.
Well, yeah, I think that I'll have to read that. That sounds like a very astute point. One of the things I think that, if we're inclined to be pessimistic about what people know and where the political currents are going, which, you know, is the very obvious thing, is we, the American people, elected Barack Obama twice, and by an even more substantial margin the second time than the first time. And the fact is that would have been unheard of, probably even 15 years earlier and any other time in American history, because obviously, you know, he's an African American, and the fact that that America could do that shows in some way that we have become liberated from the ideologies of the past. And one of the things that I do in my book, New Media, I have a whole chapter on New Media and politics, in which I talk about both elections. And what has happened is, and it's very, very interesting, for some reason that's still not completely clear to me or anyone, the Democrats and progressives, with a few exceptions, have a much better understanding of what I call new media and what is more commonly described as social media. And that indeed helped Obama in 2008 and 2012. The problem is that social media tend to be used on the national level, but not as much on local levels. So that's why we have the situation where Congress, I think, is still I think that's this is one of the explanations for why Congress is still in Republican hands. But I think it's still a very fluid situation, and it remains to be seen, you know, what ultimately happens. The Tea Party is the exception. They obviously have used an enormous amount of social media to achieve the level of prominence that they have. But nonetheless, nothing has really been enacted on the national level for the Tea Party. The most they've gotten are statewide victories. And so nationally, it looks like social media, new media have indeed created a new left, and it's indeed having impact. The Affordable Health Care Act, as I said earlier, is revolutionary in the United States, not for the rest of the world, who thinks we were crazy to have taken so long to get any kind of national health care. But this is something, as we know it, you know, Harry Truman tried to do it. Obviously, Bill Clinton tried to do it. Over and over again, it was beaten down. But finally, Obama did get it done. And I think when people look back on this age, they'll give credit to that.
Richard Nixon also was talking about national health care, and some conservative ideas. Conservative people like Milton Friedman and Richard Nixon talked about a minimum pay for people. They talked about the negative income tax and everything. But what the Tea Party has done, though, is they have these congressmen quaking their boots. They say anyone that doesn't support this government shutdown, they will run candidates in primaries against. Apparently, that's one of the big concerns that Mike McConnell had, and so many of the representatives, they're concerned about being pulled even more to the right. And it's I find that scary.
Well, I agree. I mean, this, you know, every couple of years now, there's talk of a government shutdown, and it could be very damaging. So far, though, we've managed to steer around, you know, the Scylla and Charybdis of the government shutdown on the one hand, and you know, giving into what the conservatives want on the other hand. But it is you know, a dangerous situation, and but part of that also, you know, gets to, and this is something that's really independent of social media, the Great Recession, which is, you know, the result of obviously too little government regulation of the financial sectors of the United States, that was unprecedented. You know, we've been in a recession longer than any other recession, and you know, it's you have to go back to the Great Depression to find something as serious an economic downfall as the Great Recession. And that, unfortunately, empowers people who are just frustrated. They don't want government spending. They think they're being taken advantage of. So, you know, that more than anything else, I think, is what's adding fuel to this fire.
Well, yeah, we also have to recognize, and unfortunately very few people do, that we are in a completely disruptive area. Tonight, I write about this in my creative disruption columns. Technology is replacing jobs more rapidly than it ever has, and these jobs aren't going to come back. So no matter what either of the politicians talk about, that when the economy gets better, the jobs are going to come back. The economy is better. Companies, they're doing better. But technology is allowing us through robotics or artificial intelligence and through making the customer part of the process. By people paying bills online means that there's no longer anyone at Con Ed opening envelopes. There's no longer anyone keying information in. There's no longer anyone bringing checks to the bank and depositing them. And this will continue at an even more rapid pace as we automate more and more and more. And we aren't looking at how to deal with that. There are two professors from MIT whose book, Race Against the Machine, tries to deal with it. Robert Rice has been writing about it, and Mother Jones has been talking about it. But everyone seems to think that by 2040, that there will be less people working, there'll be less people supporting more people. And I don't know what the answer is to what they're going to have to start paying people to coach Little League or to be Girl Scout triple leaders or to do what we normally do now, but the economy is changing. It needs long-range planning, and the politicians have to be involved. And the politicians that we have can't plan for 3 months, never mind 10 years. It's a very unsettling time.
Well, I agree. By the way, Bob, are you still online here?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, I mean, I just wanted to mention, as long as Bob is here, because it relates to an earlier topic that we were talking about, that Bob has written a fabulous novel called Executive Severance, and it was written completely on Twitter. Literally, each tweet became another line in the novel. So I highly recommend it to anyone who enjoys a good mystery with a lot of comedy and humor, and also the knowledge that this was something that was written in tweets. So, you know, not to get too far away from politics, but just another example of how this revolution in media is having an impact on all elements of society, including the process of writing and publishing.
How have you published it, Bob?
Neopoesis Press has gathered all the tweets together in book form and added illustrations by a West Coast artist named David Arshofsky. And
okay.
It's in a package that you get on Amazon. Thank you, Paul.
Yeah, you're welcome. Bob occasionally does live readings of the of his novel, and I've heard parts of them, and it's hilarious.
By the way, David Brooks went to the University of Chicago. I just thought I'd throw that in.
Okay, it was the University of Chicago that Buckley spoke at then. Yep.
Yeah.
Actually, and as long as we're correcting things, when you introduced me, you said I had like something like six nonfiction books.
But I said you...
it's okay. It's more like nine. And
okay.
The other point is I've never co-written a book with anybody.
It's mentioned there are some names on Amazon. When I did the count, there were two books that had other people's names on them.
Really? I have to look into it. Well, bear in mind, I've edited books with other editors. So there's a book on The Sopranos, which is actually based on a conference that I organized at Fordham University about The Sopranos back in 2008 with two other people in the academic world. And so the book that has come out with papers from the conference has all three of our names on there. So maybe you were seeing that. But I'm one of the reasons why I like writing is I like being God in my own universe. So over the years, I think I've maybe co-written one or two short stories with other people, but I basically don't like the process because I don't like anybody else telling me what to do when I'm writing. But other people feel differently. Yeah, so.
I agree completely. The one successful combination I thought was when Bruce Sterling and Don William Gibson did
The Difference Engine. Yeah, The Difference Engine is a masterpiece. I love that too. Great
book. I thought that worked well. Yeah.
Yeah. Good.
Well, do we have anything else that we haven't said? We lost 10 minutes, but we've picked up another 35. So is there anything else that you wanted to bring up before I end the episode?
Well, I had a great time, and I know that this is going to be the beginning of a great series John, and I am honored indeed to have been able to launch this series with you. So I hope that's here for like another 10, 15 years or longer.
Thank you very much. Now, next week, as I mentioned, we'll have Brother Claire Woodley, who's director of the local Episcopal Church here and has done so much with food pantries and helping the community. She's also a candidate for the bishop in the Episcopal Church. Then we're going to have the novelist at some point, Thomas Kelly, who wrote Rackets and Empire Rising. We're going to have the former federal prosecutor, Mark Rausch, who's an expert in telecommunications and computer crime. And so hopefully we'll have a good time.
Great. I just let all your listeners know, if anybody's listening right now, I'm going to be watching Breaking Bad, Dexter, and go to paullevinson.net, which is another way of getting to Infinite Regress, and you'll see my reviews of Dexter and Breaking Bad there, and Boardwalk Empire as well.
Okay. Thank you very much. And, Bob, thanks for calling in. Then thanks to Don Shea and to Maggie Mulvihill, who called in. And as Michael Chase is after the Yankee games, but as we always said in my neighborhood, see ya.
Thanks. Take care, John. Bye.